Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A little-known chapter in history in which politics, personalities, and St. Louis played roles. It involves William Clark of Lewis and Clark and his role in something branded the Spanish Conspiracy. A few years before the famous and heroic westward trek, maybe somewhat less than honorable. It's all detailed by Missouri historian Joanne Trogdon in her book, The Unknown Travels and Dubious Pursuits of William Clark. She joins us from KBIA in Columbia, Missouri. Joanne, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Don. Thank you.
You know, I have to give you a 10 out of 10 for the research you did for this book. I mean, it's just an enormous amount of work had to go into it, trying to tie so much of this information together.
Yes, indeed. And had I known it would be so much work when I first found the journal, oh gosh, in 1992, I would have had more trepidations about, you know, diving into it. But curiosity drove me. I thought, what was Clark doing? How does all this add up? So one thing led to another.
Well, tell us about finding the journal and what specifically in it that piqued your curiosity.
Yes. Well, specifically, it was the years 1798 to 1801. It was very specifically used during only those years. And the reason I was looking to find out what Clark was doing during those years is that there was a question that arose out of my previous book. In 1991, my book, then my name was Joanne Brown, my book came out. It was a history of St. Charles, specifically through the Catholic parish, St. Charles Borromeo. And I used the parish registers of baptisms, weddings, and funerals for specific information about what the people in St. Charles then were like and, you know, what was going on, how St. Charles developed. And there was one register which, well, back at this time, was kept during the Spanish regime, because until 1804, the Louisiana Purchase had not taken place, and, you know, the west side of the Mississippi was Spanish territory. So this one particular journal of weddings had to do with non-Catholic weddings, Protestant weddings it was called, and they were of people who were from outside St. Charles. There was a signature in that journal which showed up four times, and it was of a William Clark. And the journal was kept between 1798 to 1801. So the question arose, was that the signature of the William Clark, the future explorer? I didn't know. I went looking for information, and that was how I came upon the travel journal of William Clark, who did become the explorer, kept during those exact same years, 1798 to 1801. It has been in Columbia, Missouri, at the State Historical Society since 1928. But how it got there itself is a mysterious story.
Well, just one of the mysteries involved in all of this. This is a very complex story in many ways, so obviously we can't get into all the details, but we'll encourage people to read the book for that by bringing up some of the highlights. Let's begin with identifying what this Spanish conspiracy was.
Yes, it was an agreement that was concocted by General James Wilkinson of the U.S. Army, who was, for many years, the ranking commander of the Army, the highest officer in the Army. It's hard to believe, but in 1788, he swore an oath of loyalty to Spain, and not long after that, went on the Spanish payroll, secretly, of course. They called him Secret Agent 13. I think he was the 13th contact they had in the United States, and he was certainly the most important. And at various times, he swore to Spain that, you know, he would help detach the western United States, mostly Kentucky, from the Union and ally it in some way with Spain. And he did this for money. He was just a venal individual.
Scoundrel is too kind a word, I think, for a guy like this.
Yes, let me read you just a couple of quotations about him. He was called after it became known what he was up to. One of the prosecutors said he was, from the bark to the very core, a villain. And General Anthony Wayne of the U.S. Army, who served with him and found out what he was really like, said he was the worst of all bad men. So, yeah, he was really bad. But he was very popular and a charming individual, a real sociopath. And he charmed junior officers in the Army, one of whom was William Clark. When Clark had been in the Army earlier in the 1790s, he had become quite a supporter of Wilkinson, who was opposed to General Wayne.
This is where the plot really begins to thicken. But before we move along, why would the Spanish want these parts of the United States, Kentucky in particular, why would the Spanish want it, and why would the Kentuckians want to leave?
Well, it's not that the Kentuckians wanted to leave, but at this time, Kentucky was unprotected by the U.S. government because, really, it was across the Appalachians. So it was subject to Indian attacks, and it was also a very fertile region. It was able to grow plenty of crops, which was in stark contrast with Spanish Louisiana, which was quite unpopulated, and they were never able to feed themselves. So the products of Kentucky were of great interest to the people of Spanish Louisiana. But what Spanish Louisiana had that attracted the people of Kentucky was coinage, specifically silver dollars, Spanish silver dollars. There really was no currency at that time in the United States. They relied a lot on foreign money. So Wilkinson saw that there was great opportunity in, selling products of Kentucky to Spanish Louisiana, sort of serving as the broker, I guess, and then earning a fee. But, doing so involved disloyalty to his own country, so he took a secret oath of loyalty to Spain, and then the money started rolling in.
Your book gets started with the voyage of William Clark to New Orleans from St. Louis. And during the course of that voyage, he apparently, and it seems fairly clear, was doing some, I'll call it espionage or spy work for Wilkinson. So there was a strong connection there.
I'm not sure I can't prove that he was doing it for Wilkinson, but it would have been of tremendous use to Wilkinson. The only thing that we're lacking is documentary proof that, yes, it went to Wilkinson. But Clark, I think, was still devoted to Wilkinson. And by mapping the Mississippi as he did in his 1798 to 1801 journal, by mapping the Mississippi, which, on one side was Spanish territory, he was violating Spanish law against espionage. And he knew there had been a famous case in 1796, just 2 years earlier, of a French general who had descended the Mississippi and surreptitiously made beautiful maps of it and studied their defenses, got busted and thrown in jail, and then expelled from Spanish territory. This had drawn a lot of press, and Clark knew about it. So he knew that what he was doing could have gotten him in serious trouble, but he went ahead and did it.
Would have gotten him in serious trouble with the Spaniards.
Spain.
Yeah.
Yes.
So this doesn't make him a bad guy in our book. It makes him somewhat of a patriot, doesn't it?
Well, it makes him certainly an opportunistic American. I'm not sure that this was patriotic, but yeah, what he was doing, a lot of traveling to New Orleans to sell trade goods and make money, that's what a lot of Americans wanted to do. So in doing that, yeah, Clark was, I guess he would have been a hero to some people. Once he got to New Orleans, though, he began writing in his journal about bribing the Spanish officials to whom he owed a duty, an import tax on the goods he brought. He brought two flatboats loaded with tobacco and furs and some cured pork, ham and bacon, to sell. And one of the curious things to me was that once he got to New Orleans, he stopped writing about, his business. But he did make money, and then he began writing about bribing the Spanish officials with wine and various things, and then he didn't pay them the amount of the duty that was owed. But I think he paid them otherwise.
But isn't that sort of the way business was done back in that particular time?
Yes, it was. Yes, and that was very opportunistic. And I think, too, that it would not have raised eyebrows in the United States. But, of course, Clark was in foreign territory, and he was brazenly breaking the law of the foreign territory, Spain.
Is there any evidence that he had any idea about Wilkerson's kind of double dealings here and his work for Spain?
Oh, that's the $64 question.
Right.
Yeah. It doesn't make sense to me that he would have been totally ignorant. After all, Wilkinson surreptitiously had ruined the reputation of Clark's elder brother, George Rogers Clark, who had been a hero for his work in the American Revolution until Wilkinson damaged his reputation. I'm not sure how much of that William knew, probably not much at all. But he had to know that many considered Wilkinson, as I said, the worst of all bad men.
Well, again, the plot begins to become more complicated because taking money out of that particular part of out of the Spanish territory was certainly against the law. But William Clark found himself right in the middle of smuggling money.
Yes, and again, he wrote about this. He wrote about this in his journal. I put it together, I think, because I matched his entries with information in Spanish archives, which I was familiar with because I had used them in my history of St. Charles. So when I saw that, you know, William Clark said he arrived at New Orleans on such and such a day, I checked the treasury records in of Spanish New Orleans and found that, yes, indeed, they called him Guillermo Clark, but, you know, Guillermo means William.
Sure.
Showed up, and he was from Kentucky, and yes, he had, and they had many details that Clark didn't keep, which made me wonder then if this was really a business journey or was Clark engaged in it for some other reason.
Well, you point out in the book that he was well aware that he shouldn't be writing certain things down in case that journal were found by the Spaniards.
Yes, yes. Yes, indeed. But he boldly entered into his journal, as I said, about bribery. In fact, he was not much of a speller. So he said,
oh.
he said, I gave a B-R-I-A-B bribe to the Spanish officer, customs officer, $3.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But as far as smuggling is concerned, he wrote two parts in his journal about getting a certain sum, two different sums of Spanish money upriver. They were hidden in barrels of, one in a barrel of coffee and the other in a barrel of sugar. And one was $260, and it was for a Mr. Sebastian, who was a judge on the Kentucky Court of Appeals. He was Wilkinson's lawyer, and he was involved in the conspiracy. So Clark helped smuggle his secret Spanish dollars up to Sebastian. The other sum was $670, much more, and it was the same amount of money that Spain then owed Wilkinson. Clark did not name Wilkinson, unlike Sebastian, but he did say that it was going through a riverman, a boatman named Mr. Riddle, and it was exactly the right amount of money, and Wilkinson had been agitating for that amount of money. And then afterwards, Wilkinson stopped agitating. So I think it probably went to Wilkinson.
Yes. And did William Clark know what he was doing, what he was doing was wrong, was illegal, and all of that?
That depends on whether he knew the details of the conspiracy. He may have thought that this money to Sebastian was for business purposes. You know, perhaps Sebastian had sent cargoes downriver. But he hadn't, because I checked those records, too. And years later, Sebastian was busted and investigated in Kentucky, and he confessed to everything, that, yes, he had been involved in the conspiracy, and, yes, he had been receiving Spanish dollars. And, of course, he lost his judicial position and his reputation as well. So it's quite a stretch to me that Clark believed that this was legitimate money. On the other hand, I can't prove it.
There's so much, I'm sure, that you would like to know after having done all this research. I have to take a break, Joanne. Let's do that now. We'll come back and continue the conversation. I'm talking with Joanne Trogdon. She is the author of The Unknown Travels and Dubious Pursuits of William Clark. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Back back to our conversation with Joanne Trogdon, author of The Unknown Travels and Dubious Pursuits of William Clark. You know, you mentioned, Joanne, you mentioned his spelling. And I had to laugh throughout the book because, you know, he would take certain words and spell them differently every time he came across them. But you write in the book that he was actually quite well read. And that surprised me that the spelling was so bad.
Yes, he was not formally educated. But yeah, he was very well read, and he valued education. You laugh about spelling. I think I read that on the Pacific Expedition, of course, with Meriwether Lewis and the Corps of Discovery, he managed somehow to spell the word mosquito 26 different ways.
Well, I remember reading Undaunted Courage, and it was 26 different times because mosquitoes were about the biggest problem they faced for a large part of that journey, as I recall.
Yes, yeah. He complained about them more than anything else.
How frustrating for you in trying to put this together, because you came close on so many occasions, and we talked off the air about these gaps in his writing, and you mentioned it earlier that, you know, he was fairly prolific, and then all of a sudden it would stop for a period of days, or he'd come someplace new, and when you would expect him to be talking about certain things, nothing.
Yes, that's what made me doubt my original assumption that his journal in 1798 was kept as a business journal, because I thought if this is a business journal, once he gets to his destination, Spanish New Orleans, where he was to sell his cargoes, he would write details about, you know, what they sold for, at least. And no, in contrast, he wrote almost nothing. And he began writing such innocent-sounding things, such as nothing extraordinary happened. He wrote that in succession, I think, for 2 weeks, for each day. And, of course, there were things happening. During that time, as I found through other sources, he was engaged with a very powerful merchant then, Daniel Clark Jr., who was not a relative of his, who was monitoring the Spanish conspiracy and other things. So William Clark was very busy during that time, but he wrote almost nothing. And the details I got about his cargoes came almost exclusively from Spanish sources, not from Clark's own journal. So, yeah, he was not there for primarily a business purpose. Otherwise, he would have written about it.
You would think. Going back to the maps and the information that he was compiling during the voyage down the Mississippi, whatever happened to them? I mean, were they ever given to someone?
No, that information in the journal stayed with his family until, well, after Clark's death. And I know this because his son, Meriwether Lewis Clark, whose initials, of course, were MLC, commented. He took a pencil and wrote little notes on this journal. He didn't date them, but I'm sure it was after Clark's death. So sometime maybe in the 1840s or 1850s, Meriwether Lewis Clark made these pencil notes in the journal. And then after that, the journal somehow wound up in St. Louis in 1923, where it was sold for 50 cents. Can you believe it? 50 cents, along with three other journals of Clark and one of Meriwether Lewis. Guess how much the one of Meriwether Lewis went for?
Go ahead.
A nickel. Can you believe it? So the total amount that the buyer paid for these five journals in total, four of Clark and one of Lewis, was $1.55. Oh my gosh, I'm just flabbergasted, because now if those were on the market, they'd go in six figures or more.
I would guess more. I would guess seven figures, given what's going on today. Go ahead.
Oh, well, that's part of the reason why the story in this 1798 to 1801 journal has remained unknown, because I think it was in a journal that no one valued, obviously. And after 1923, the buyer, his name was William Clark Breckinridge. Again, he was not a relation of William Clark. He died. He was in St. Louis. He belonged to the Missouri Historical Society and to the State Historical Society of Missouri and Columbia. After he died, then the State Historical Society bought the journal, along with 1,000-something other relics that this collector had, for the sum total of about $1,000. So, you know, maybe $1 for it. And it was unknown and unstudied for quite a long time afterwards.
Another part of the story that's fascinating, and this relates more to General Wilkerson than Wilkinson than to Clark necessarily, was the concern that at some point the word was going to be out. I mean, Wilkinson could have been hanged, could he not, for what he had done?
Oh, definitely. Yes, he could have, and he was well aware of that. So that early after the Louisiana Purchase, once the Spanish archives then went on to other Spanish places, Wilkinson knew that were they ever discovered, you know, he would be ruined and, you know, probably executed. He sent secret messages to the Spanish in West Florida, in Pensacola, where that was the first destination of the Spanish archives from Louisiana. And his message was, get rid of them, send them on to Spain or do something because I'm ruined if these things are discovered. And the response was, don't worry, they've gone on to Cuba, which they had, and eventually they went on to Spain. Spain was very reluctant to let Americans have access to materials, even that had nothing to do with the Spanish conspiracy. Because Spain knew that it would wreck U.S.-Spanish relations. That's another reason why this story has not come out, because it remained hidden in Seville, Spain, until early in the 20th century.
And you did have access to those archives.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Those have been revealed. In fact, the Library of Congress has a large collection of them. And, well, the Missouri History Museum, which was the Missouri Historical Society, has a good collection that relates to St. Louis as well.
William Clark was also concerned at some point, as I recall, it's been a couple of weeks since I read your book, about some of his activities coming out later. Was he not? Was he not?
Yes, I'm sure he was, but he kept everything he wrote, I believe, because he had also kept a very inflammatory journal back in 1794 when he was during his first stint in the army, during the height of the battle between Wilkinson and General Anthony Wayne. And Clark had been firmly on the side of Wilkinson, who was Anthony Wayne's junior officer. But Clark kept in this journal, which he may have kept for Wilkinson's benefit, he kept the journal, although it showed that he was... He did not like Wayne, who had won the battle and, you know, done what Wilkinson told him not to do. But Wayne was the one who was in the right. And Clark, for some reason, kept that journal for the rest of his life, too. So, but as far as the 1798 to 1801 journal goes, he never used it after 1801. It did become, I think, kind of a mystery in his own family. And when his son, Meriwether Lewis Clark, the one with the pencil, checked it years later, it seemed the import of what Clark was really doing in that journal just totally escaped him. The notes he made were about very trivial things.
And, of course, he went on to for the next journal, which was relative to the expedition to the West, in which he distinguished himself, and then he distinguished himself beyond that for the next 30 years.
Yes, he did, in St. Louis.
Yeah.
He moved to St. Louis in 1808. He married in 1809. And I think later, in 1808, he bought 1,400 acres of beautiful land in St. Louis. It was then, of course, all St. Louis City. But now it lies between St. Louis and the suburbs of Pine Lawn and Northwoods. And there, in those 1,400 acres, Clark served the public by negotiating with Indian tribes that came to visit. They would send large delegations, and they would camp on this property. Well, Clark built a country house there for himself. After he died, those 1,400 acres were divided among his surviving children, who were all boys. Among those acres, I think the largest tract, 500 acres, went to his youngest son, who built a beautiful Italianate mansion there in 1856, a slave labor, and he called the place Monoma. In Monoma, I think, this son, Jefferson Clark, kept the relics, the historic artifacts, and the journals of his father. They were there until about 1900 when Jefferson Clark sold the property. So that ties in. That's one of the reasons, I think, why Williams Journal has survived but hasn't been well known. For a long time, I think it was in a special room that his son, Jefferson Kearney Clark, erected at this beautiful mansion of his. And in the room, he kept, the weapons and a lot of artifacts from out west, and then probably the journals, too.
Well, we only have a few seconds left. The $64 question for you is, what do you think about William Clark? Hero, villain, a little bit of both?
A little bit of both, but certainly a three-dimensional individual. He was not just the rather plain cardboard sidekick of Meriwether Lewis that he has come to seem. I think maybe he encouraged that rather simplified view of himself later in life. But oh no, he was a complex individual.
Well, it's a complex story, but a very well done story by you, Joanne Trogdon. The book is The Unknown Travels and Dubious Pursuits of William Clark. Folks who are listening who are history buffs, and even if you're not, you might find this a fascinating, little known chapter in American history. Joanne Trogdon, thank you so much for being with us. Let us remind our audience that you are going to be appearing this Thursday at 7 o'clock at the St. Louis County Library to be talking about your book, The Unknown Travels and Dubious Pursuits of William Clark, Thursday at 7 o'clock at the St. Louis County Library on Lindbergh. We'll be back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.